Hi, I'm Dimitri Papadimitriou, and I'd like to welcome you all here on behalf of the Migration Policy Institute and the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, that is actually the part of MPI that gives out these awards. I'd like to welcome representatives from the Diplomatic Corps, from federal, state, and local agencies, members of Congress and their staff, and also colleagues and friends. It is an occasion that we take extreme pride on, and we are very grateful to the J.M. Kaplan Foundation for the opportunity for us to help choose exceptional people and programs like the ones that are receiving the awards today. And we are fortunate again and grateful to have Brad Davidson here from the Kaplan board. And also, we were trying to figure out whether they were the third or the fourth generation. You know, there's a bit of an argument, so would you please figure it out, because they disagree. A couple members of the fourth generation. And it is really, you know, wonderful to have you here. And, of course, Con Nugent, who is the boss over there at the foundation and a good friend. And he reminds me all the time. I should start reminding him that he's responsible for my low quality of life. But he reminds me of the fact that he helped start us, the Migration Policy Institute, which is actually true. And it's a nice story, which I'm not allowed to tell because it takes time. And, of course, Suzette Brooks-Masters, from whom you already heard. And, you know, today we're really, this is an evening that's supposed to accomplish three things. First of all, it's an evening of celebration. Celebration of exceptional leaders leading exceptional institutions that make and have been making, in fact, for many years, immigration work for immigrants and for Americans alike. And I don't think that there is a higher calling than that. It's also an evening of learning. We've had the opportunity to hear from senior members of the administration a lot of thoughtful words about what it is they do, how they try to deal with the issue of immigrant integration. But tonight, this afternoon and tonight, we also wanted to have an opportunity to learn from each other about things that work, about things that are replicable, and about things that create the virtuous cycles that add value to all our efforts toward better integration outcomes for all. Because fundamentally, this is what the Kaplan Fund wanted to really try to accomplish through these awards. Focus on building community, on moving forward together, on doing better for all of us and by all of us. And this is also an evening of hope for all of those who fear that we have lost our way on immigrant integration, that after 500 years, the American integration machine has stalled. Let me tell you, after having read 1,000-plus applications the last 2 years, the last thing, and this was not pleasant, it's pleasant to actually pick the winners, but the award, the reward, is to always get the sense jumping out of the pages that that American, the great American integration machine is fine, it works well, it happens every day through the actions of people like you. We're merely the agents that transfer some money from one source to another. You are the great heroes of this continuing effort of America to remain something that no other country has really managed, which is a country that is defined by the verb becoming rather than the verb is. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce people who have to say much better, more important, interesting things than me, to introduce Tom Perez, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. And Tom has been a friend of the Institute, and we're grateful for that. He has been Secretary of Labor, and it's interesting considering some of our awardees, Secretary of Maryland's Department of Labor, Licensing and Regulation, which includes just about everything that we've talked about today. And he has been for a long time before that. He was a professional in the Department of Justice in the same division. He reached the level of Deputy Assistant Attorney General on that. He was a senior aide to the late Ted Kennedy, and a former law professor. And it is a privilege, and we're indeed honored to have you here, Tom, to address us all, and particularly the people who won these wonderful awards. Tom Perez, please.
Demetrius, thank you so much for your kind words. You know how to throw a celebration here, and you know how to throw it in a wonderful place. When I first learned of this, and I was first invited by my good friend Michael Fix, when Michael Fix asks me to jump, I have only one response, and that is how high, because Michael and I and others have done a lot of work together. We've been in a number of foxholes, and the Migration Policy Institute has done such a remarkable amount of critically hard work and critically important work telling the story of how immigrants have enriched our nation. And so when I had this opportunity, it was very, very easy to say absolutely, and I would love to be here. And it's wonderful to see so many old friends. When I think about immigrant integration, like so many of you, I cannot help but think about my own family story. My parents emigrated here from the Dominican Republic. My maternal grandfather was the ambassador to the United States from the Dominican Republic until he spoke out after the massacre of the Haitians in the mid-30s and was declared non grata. So they were here. My mom was the youngest of nine. They had no money. They had no home country, and it was the middle of the Depression, but they had a remarkable, bless you, bless all of you, for that matter. This is a wonderful celebration. And bless all the immigrants, for that matter. And they had a remarkable stick-to-itiveness and a remarkable optimism, and they settled in what for all Dominicans became Mecca, otherwise known as Washington Heights, and had a wonderful life. And my father was part of the student movement, and he had to leave as well, got drafted as a legal immigrant when he was living in Puerto Rico. Like my four uncles who served in World War II as legal immigrants, and as you all know, legal immigrants have been serving our nation's military since the Revolutionary War and making the ultimate sacrifice in some cases since the Revolutionary War. And so I can't help but think about the story of my family and how this country did so much for them and how they had so many people helping them in their integration to the United States. And I can't help but think of the fact that in the most recent war in Iraq, the first fatality, the first U.S. fatality, was an immigrant, a person who initially came as an undocumented immigrant from Guatemala, had his status adjusted, enlisted in the U.S. Army, made the ultimate sacrifice, and was awarded citizenship posthumously. That is the story of immigrants in America. The story of immigrant integration is as old as the story of immigration in America. I remember studying the history of immigration into the state of Maryland and learning about the Royal Order of Hibernians helping Irish immigrants in the mid-1800s who were coming from Ireland, other organizations helping other European immigrants. Maryland, after Ellis Island, was the second largest entry point for many years at the turn of the 20th century. And so our lives are enriched with so many stories. And when I think about immigrant integration, I can't help but think again of my old boss, Senator Kennedy, who was such a champion in the immigration movement, who was such a champion of vulnerable people, and who had on his office as a reminder of his family's history, the no Irish need apply, help wanted, He understood what Reverend Martin Niemoyer said when he said, first they came for the Jews and I didn't speak up because I wasn't Jewish. Then they came for the trade unionists and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics and I didn't speak up because I was Protestant. And then they came for me. And when they came for me, there was nobody left to speak for me. And that was what Senator Kennedy embodied, because he understood that there were going to be times in our nation's history when people would be coming for the immigrants. He understood that there would be times in our nation's history when people would be coming for folks who were LGBT. He understood that there were times in our nation's histories when people would be targeting people with disabilities, people with a Muslim surname, people who wore a headscarf. And he understood that if we are truly to achieve equal justice under law, that we must ensure that we treat the least of us like we want ourselves treated. That's what I learned from Senator Kennedy. And it was an honor to work for him during the immigration reform debate of 1996. And what I remember most about that debate is that there were roughly 70 or 75 amendments in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I suspect many of you in this room were here. I know one person who was there every single day, and that's my good friend Doris Meisner, because she was in the center of the vortex. And one thing, and Doris, you can be my witness on this, I think I need one hand to count the number of amendments that passed on a party line vote. Immigration in 96 was Alan Simpson, Ted Kennedy, and others. Immigration in 1986 was Ronald Reagan. Immigration has always been a bipartisan issue. And I remain the eternal optimist, like my former boss, Ted Kennedy, who said that immigration indeed is what we are as a nation, and that I am absolutely optimistic that we can rekindle that immigrant spirit. We can rekindle that bipartisan spirit. And yes, we have some storm clouds in the horizon, but there were storm clouds in the horizon at the turn of the 20th century when we had the Know Nothing Party, when we had other forces who wanted to divide our nation along racial lines, ethnic lines, immigrant lines. We've had these issues before, and we've always come together as a nation, recognizing that what unites us far exceeds what divides us. And what's always brought us together are the remarkable stories of nonprofits and others, people who are out there in the front lines, making sure that we provide those remarkable services for immigrants so that they can realize their highest and best talents. Because my parents taught me, as I suspect all your parents did, that the ladder should always be down. And that Hubert Humphrey was correct when he said, the moral test of our strength as a nation is how we treat those in the dawn of life, our children, how we treat those in the twilight of life, the elderly, and how we treat those in the shadows of life. And we have all too many of our friends who are immigrants who are still relegated to the shadows of our communities. And the award recipients today are bringing those remarkable people from the shadows into the sunshine. My mother helped bring my father from the shadows into the sunshine, because my mother spoke the King's English and my father spoke Ricky Ricardo English. So when he was studying for his boards, he knew medicine, but he didn't know English. And my mother was his English teacher. And so when I worked in the state of Maryland to establish a program for immigrant nurses so that they could be working on the ward instead of working sweeping floors, which is a noble occupation, an occupation, parenthetically, that is a heavily immigrant-laden occupation, but an occupation that wasn't realizing the highest and best uses of the talents of these remarkable immigrant nurses in Maryland, I thought of my father, and I thought of all the other people in the health professions, and I thought of people who have remarkable talents. And I thought of the research that Michael did for us in Maryland. And I thought about the fact that immigrants living and working in Maryland are actually more educated than their native-born counterparts. That's the story of immigrants that isn't told often enough. And that's why we have to come here today to tell that remarkable story of what immigrants are doing for America. Where would we be without immigrants in America? Where would our health professions be without immigrants staffing them? Where would medical research be without immigrants? Where would our post-secondary school teachers be without immigrants? Where would our service industries be without immigrants? I know the answer in Maryland. The answer is we would be a much lesser place. We would be not the magnet that we are for remarkable investment in biotech, because we know the entrepreneurial spirit of immigrants. And we know the critical importance that they have played in our healthcare sector. And we know the critical importance they are to our tax base. Not simply documented immigrants, but undocumented immigrants who are paying billions of dollars into our Social Security system, hoping upon hope for comprehensive immigration reform. But frankly, they're playing the lottery right now, because there is no guarantee of any return on investment for any of them. In fact, one of them is calling me now. And it was my friend Mr. Rodriguez, an immigrant from Cuba. A true story. But when I read these stories, it brings a smile to my face. One of the remarkable opportunities I had for the better part of a decade was to work with a nonprofit in Maryland that does immigrant integration called CASA Maryland. And we serve people who had been in this country for 2 weeks. We serve people who had been in this country for 2 months. We serve people who had been in the country for 2 years. And we serve people who have been in the country for 20 years. We are no longer at CASA an organization that simply helps Latino immigrants. We help immigrants from all over the world. And if you go to Langley Park, a remarkably rich and diverse area that has been written about by the New York Times and by many other people, an immigrant magnet. What I know today is that Langley Park is a remarkably rich tapestry of immigrants, mostly from Central America. What I know yesterday was that there were other immigrants from other countries. What I know for certain is that 40 years from now, 20 years from now, it'll be an immigrant haven. And the only question presented that I don't know the answer to is from what country. And that is the remarkable story of immigrant integration. And where would the immigrant community in Maryland be without CASA Maryland? They would be in much greater trouble. Where would immigrants in Illinois be without the Illinois Coalition? I have remarkable memories of going out there 12 years ago to talk about immigrant integration and learning about the remarkable work that they did. I liked them so much, I actually cherry-picked one of their employees and hired them at HHS OCR, a woman named Lisa Simeone. And I was proud to be able to cherry-pick her, because she was a remarkable advocate for vulnerable people. All of the awardees here embody the best of what America has to offer. And I hope that we cannot allow the storm clouds that we see in the horizon from time to time, whether they're in Arizona today or wherever they might be tomorrow, I hope we will not allow the storm clouds to get in the way of our broader view, because I am absolutely confident that in the end of the day, if we continue to advocate for what's right, it is always the right time to do the right thing. And when we look at our nation's history, we have always come together as a nation in a bipartisan fashion to support immigrants from all walks of life, from all corners of the globe, and in all ways, shapes, and forms. And I am confident that as a nation, we will do that. Our president is a strong supporter of comprehensive immigration reform, and he will continue to work with both sides of the aisle on that critically important issue, recognizing that the system is indeed broken. We all understand that. But we must have sensible solutions that actually address the problems at hand. And so in the meantime, we will continue to have remarkable work being done by so many of you. And I want to congratulate all of you and say, please keep up the great work, because you are absolutely ensuring that Hubert Humphrey and Ted Kennedy's hope to have everybody out of the shadows and into the sunshine is a hope that we will indeed realize. And you have my word that at the government and the Department of Justice and this administration, we will continue to work with you to ensure that we are able to tap into the highest and best uses of our immigrant talent pool, because this president recognizes, and this attorney general recognizes, and this assistant attorney general recognizes, that the work you're doing in this room is so critically important. And we hope you will advocate not only for your communities that you're serving, but we hope you will continue to come to Washington to tell the story, because frankly, we're oftentimes losing the battle of the soundbite. We all too frequently only hear the bad stories about immigrants. And the reason I wanted to come here today is to celebrate the remarkably wonderful stories of immigration and immigrants, because those remarkably wonderful stories far outnumber the other stories. And that's the challenge that we all have, is to tell that story, to make sure the word is out, to bring out the better angels in people. And I know the better angels are there, Republicans, Democrats, Independents. They've been there before. They are here today. And we need to simply message the word, get the word out, tell the story of all of the remarkable reward recipients and all the other thousands, because I'm going to guess, Demetrius, that there were very, very, very few nominees that didn't merit serious consideration. I'm going out on a limb and saying 95% of these nominees were very, very worthy nominees, and that's probably conservative, which tells me that in every corner of this country, whether it's Lincoln, Nebraska, or Lincoln, Rhode Island, whether it's Montgomery County, Maryland, or Montgomery, Alabama, we have people working for our remarkable immigrant integration and people working to build a better nation. And if we continue to do that, and we continue to hang tough, and we continue to remember what Winston Churchill said in World War II, when things seemed as bleak as possible, he gave the shortest speech in the history of speech giving by modern officials. And he said, "Don't give up. Don't ever give up. Don't ever, ever give up." That is what the immigrant integration movement is about. And that is what the award recipients embody. And this evening tonight is a celebration not only of you, but of the immigrant spirit, which will carry us to reform, carry us to even better heights, and show the world that we continue to be a nation that welcomes our immigrants, that values every person, and that wants to ensure that we can make the highest and best uses of people's talents. So thank you for having me here. I am sorry I had a meeting that I just got out of on a matter relating to some issues here, and I have a meeting that I need to go back to. So I apologize for the fact that I am unable to stay for the award recipients. But thank you very much for allowing me to come and say a few words.
Thank you so much for those rousing and warm and wonderful, inspiring words. What a great way to get going on this awards program. Michael will be back. So we're very happy to be able to begin the awards program with an honorable mention for a household name in the United States and many other parts of the world, McDonald's Corporation. Many of you know that immigrants are heavily represented in the restaurant and service industries, and a major factor in their ability to move up the job ladder is their proficiency in English. The McDonald's English Under the Arches program helps immigrant workers continue on the management track by assisting them in building higher-level English skills for addressing customer relations and employee management issues. It allows employees to improve their English skills by joining a live class over the web from their place of work, helping busy adult learners maximize perhaps their most precious resource, their time. And it provides a model to other employers for how they might build relationships with community colleges and other adult education providers to offer English instruction to their employees. Betsy McKay, the Director of Bilingual Leadership at McDonald's, whom you met earlier, has worked tirelessly with leaders in the adult ESL and technology fields to create this program, and she's here with us tonight. Betsy, it is such a pleasure to be able to present you and the McDonald's Corporation with this award in recognition of the very, very impressive program that you have created and the model and the message it sends about the win-win nature of helping immigrant employees succeed in the workplace. Please join me in welcoming Betsy and Edna Barrera, a shift manager for McDonald's, who is a graduate of the English Under the Arches program. Congratulations.
Thank you, Margie, for that warm introduction. And thank you to the Migration Policy Institute and the J.M. Kaplan Fund for recognizing English Under the Arches. All of us are working toward the same goal, and it's encouraging to see such passion as well as demonstrated success in helping people build the skills and confidence they need to fully participate in their communities and places of work. Our English Under the Arches program is unique to our industry in that it allows our employees to spend most of the time learning English in the context of the restaurant. For so many of our employees, this has made all the difference because they're learning English using the terms of the language they hear every day on the job, and the majority of the instruction is delivered while they're in the crew room of their restaurants through live instructor-led virtual classes. In the U.S., McDonald's and its franchisees employ around 700,000 people, a very diverse workforce, which brings with it many opportunities to assist immigrants across the country. Through year-end 2009, we've had 500 employees advance through the program with 85% graduating, 92% staying in the employment of McDonald's, which is significant in the industry that experiences high turnover, and 96% receiving wage increases because they're able to progress in their roles and responsibilities. But as with so many of our programs, the numbers pale in comparison to the impact we're having on individual lives. It's the individual stories of our students that do a much better job of painting the picture, which is why I'd like to introduce one of my favorite English Under the Arches graduates. It's my privilege to stand here with Edna Barrera, now a salaried manager for one of our franchisee restaurants in the Baltimore, Washington region. Edna, would you mind sharing your story?
Thanks, Lexi. Thanks. Before I took the class, I was afraid of a lot of things, as we're in the phone at work, talking to the customers, and with my coworkers. I was afraid of talking to my children's teachers. No one could understand what I was saying. But now, the people I work with and my customer can understand me. I have relationships with them. I can help fix customer complaints. My work in English is better. So I have been promoted to first assistant manager. Outside of work, I can talk with my daughters and sons teacher. Before, I couldn't understand what they were saying about my own children. But now I can talk to them, and I can help my daughter and son with their homework. I'm not scared anymore. If I'm in trouble, I can talk to the police. If I'm lost, I can ask for directions. English Under the Arches has changed my life. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Edna. And as we've continued to expand the reach of English under the arches throughout McDonald's, you continue to be a shining example of what's possible.
Thanks.
You're an inspiration to me.
Yeah.
You're an inspiration to the people you work with.
Yes.
And, of course, to your family and friends.
Yes. Thank you.
And that's something I believe all of our programs have in common. The impact that we're having goes far beyond the individual students. When Edna's confidence builds in the workplace as a result of her improved language skills, she takes that confidence with her into her family and into her community. For McDonald's, it's yet another powerful way to bring our core values to life. You know, in our industry, we love innovation and change. Most of the time, we prefer to be the only ones on the block, offering the latest and greatest sandwich or new drink or convenience. But this time around, we're very happy to see more companies pursue an approach like ours. With the help of the Migration Policy Institute and events like this, which can draw attention to the successful immigrant integration programs, that can happen. So again, thank you for recognizing English Under the Arches and for the opportunity to share Edna's story, which is the reason we're all here today.
I promised Grace Ho that we would lionize her later in the program, and her time has come. Well, I'd like to say a few words about the Illinois Department of Human Services and the Illinois Coalition of Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Just say a few words about what really struck us strongly when we were reviewing these proposals. When you look at this proposal, when you look at these organizations, they really are a model, a national model of public-private partnerships. They combine the skills and the resources of one of the most forward-leaning non-governmental organizations in the country with a state that has a long, abiding commitment to integration and to access for immigrants. This is, after all, the state where Jane Addams founded Travelers and Immigrant Aid at the turn of the century. And it's clear, as we've heard today, that this is a partnership that serves as a catalyst for the state executive order on immigrant integration that's led the way for other states, for Maryland and for a block of other states across the country. The program just struck us as a blend of very smart, very effective program initiatives. One that the extremely successful civic engagement program that promotes citizenship. It's one of the most systematic and successful efforts in the country to make a large state agency accessible to non-English-speaking potential clients. And the program has also created a very effective one-stop center where immigrants can look for work, they can look for child care, rehabilitative services, and other services. But what's really impressive about the Illinois effort, I think, and what has really struck us, is the unswerving character of the commitment of the state and of ICIR to integration, to immigrant integration, a commitment that's now been sustained for over a decade and in the face of both political change and a very tough economy. So with that, I'd like to bring Grace up along with Lawrence Benito, to accept the award.
Let's not forget the
most
important thing. Thank you.
Yeah, he'll take the
First of all, I want to thank, of course, the Migration Policy Institute and the Kaplan Fund for this honor. The award dollars are fabulous. But even more so, having it come from MPI is what makes it special for us. In our work, we have many times sought counsel, data, connections from MPI, and we thank you for it. Lawrence and I are so pleased to be here to accept this award on behalf of the Illinois Department of Human Services and the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. We are so proud to be the recipients of the E Pluribus Unum Award and are so glad that the embargo has been lifted because we've been wanting to tell everyone we meet about this accomplishment. So that has been a great source of stress. As you can imagine, good news in Illinois state government has become increasingly rare, and this award is certainly a bright spot in our day, in our month, in our year, and I would also say our careers. Now, Lawrence and I have actually worked together on immigrant rights issues for over 10 years now. We have different roles now than we did 10 years ago when we first met. Me now as a government bureaucrat and him as a pesky advocate. And even in our roles, we are still united around immigrant integration issues and our passion for providing opportunities for immigrant families to live productive lives in our country. Fortunately, we have found places to work where our commitment to immigrants are not only welcomed, but encouraged and cultivated. And when I say places of work, I not only mean the Department of Human Services and the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, but I do refer to Illinois state government and the state as a whole. The former governor created the first new Americans executive order, the first of its kind in the country, and the current governor has recently issued his new Americans executive order, and so this movement will continue in Illinois. Further, through the hard work and tenacity of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights and its member agencies, they have become a force to be reckoned with on a state and increasingly a national level. As a result, the General Assembly has become an entity that also supports immigrant integration efforts. What we've tried to do in Illinois is to empower the 500,000 legal permanent residents, the 735,000 naturalized citizens, and the 1.5 million U.S.-born children of immigrants to care not only about issues that are germane to their immediate lives and the lives of their families, but also to ask, to encourage, empower, and educate them to care about the 500,000 undocumented individuals in Illinois. Unity, sisterhood, brotherhood, empathy, and sympathy. It takes a comprehensive approach, a true partnership based on shared values and commitment to accomplish all that we have, from implementing a language proficiency test for bilingual employees and interpreters to a full-service welcoming center to establishing the new American citizenship program and a public benefits linkages program to the neighbor-to-neighbor program. We come together, Lawrence and I, and our organizations around innovative civic engagement strategies and an integrated streamlined service delivery system. We work proactively, collaboratively, and intentionally. And in these budget times, there is no room for redundancy, waste, or miscommunication. They do what we can't do, and we do what they can't do. You know, acceptance speeches often include quotes from inspirational leaders, and I will do the same, but the way that I came to find these quotes is somewhat unconventional. I was reading Vanity Fair. Yesterday morning, I was sitting next to Lawrence flying into D.C., and I was reading an American Express advertisement that asked Jeffrey Canada, who many of you probably know is the director of the Harlem Children's Zone, several questions. And Jeffrey was asked, you know, what we do for others, and his answer was, we level the playing field. And that's really what I think immigrant integration is. It's not a special magical gift we are giving to people. It's about opportunities and it's about possibilities. And what they choose to do with those opportunities and possibilities is up to them. Different individuals have different barriers and challenges to reaching opportunities and maximizing their possibilities. The Department of Human Services and Illinois Coalition have tried to break down some of those barriers so that through hard work, determination, grit, sacrifice, and courage, immigrants through hard work can achieve what they want in life. And if you ask most immigrants, like my parents and like Lawrence's parents, why they came to the United States and what they wanted from America, it's not a big house with a fancy pool and a fancy car, or food stamps for that matter, or Medicaid, or TANF. The people coming to our welcoming center and into the doors of our community agencies are asking for help to find a job to care for their family. And they are perfectly 100% okay with sacrificing their own happiness for their children. Immigrant integration is not a luxury any more than a good education for the children in Harlem. So with that, I hope that our good work in Illinois can grow in our state and throughout others. Thanks so very much again to MPI and the Kaplan Fund for honoring us and supporting us in the work we've done and to build coalitions with our partners in other states. And finally, I just wanted to give a shout-out to Chris and the other staff at the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant Refugee Rights who put our hard work into paper so that we could have a successful application. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Grace and Lawrence, and congratulations on a very well-deserved honor. So our next awardee has had simply stunning success in helping immigrants build wealth, creating a member-owned community credit union to provide banking services to tens of thousands of previously unbanked individuals. Their award-winning bilingual financial education program has helped thousands of immigrant families understand how to make the most of their money and establish credit, avoid predatory lending practices, and realize their American dream, including, in many cases, owning a home with a mortgage that they can afford. And on top of it all, the profits from these wealth-building services go back to members and into their community. What a remarkable model, and what a delight for us to be able to raise up this extraordinary organization and the visionary and dedicated leaders who have helped it grow by leaps and bounds in just 10 years' time. It's our great pleasure to award the E. Pluribus Unum Prize to the Latino Community Credit Union and acknowledge the outstanding work of its executive director, Luis Pastor, and its board of directors, represented tonight by Edgardo Emery Calon. Congratulations.
Good evening, and thank you to the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy and the Kaplan Fund for this great opportunity. On behalf of the 54,000 members of Latino Community Credit Union, we're just deeply humbled by this honor. I recall in the late 90s, the year actually summer 1997, attending many vigils for usually men who were murdered in Durham, North Carolina, because they were immigrants who carried their money in their pockets. They did not have access to financial institutions, things that we take for granted, like checking accounts, saving accounts. So they were easy prey for those looking for easy money, or as someone once called them, basically walking ATMs. And things have changed since that summer of 1997 and those years with the formation of the Latino Community Credit Union, which began as a grassroots movement of people from the community, churches, nonprofits, who were looking for solutions, creative solutions to this problem of immigrant crime, and crime not committed by immigrants, but against immigrants. The creation of the credit union, or la cooperativa, as we call it, has changed the climate dramatically. More branches have meant fewer vigils. And for that, I am deeply, deeply grateful. The creation of the credit union, La Cooperativa, now Latinos have a safe place to keep our money. And we found in La Cooperativa an institution that truly cares for our well-being, a place where people can pronounce our names rightly, and also who share our dreams. It is indeed a tribute to the diligence of our members and the vision of our community that what 10 years ago began as a grassroots experiment to curb violence is now a model for providing financial services to immigrant communities. We're often asked, what is the secret of your success? And I would say three things. First, that it started as grassroots. Second, that we found such strong community partners, Anglos community, the Afro-American community, and the Latino community coming together. And third, our superb staff that is second to none, I would say, not just in the state, but nationally. It is really this coming together of partners around this issue that has allowed us to achieve this tremendous amount of success and for which we are greatly grateful that you are recognizing us today. At La Cooperativa, we are committed to increasing financial independence of low-income and Latino individuals. We believe in the dignity of all people, in the right of hardworking families who have never before used a financial institution to have access to those services that we take for granted. We believe that financial education is critical to address the needs of unbanked and underbanked individuals by helping increase member understanding of financial services in the United States. We also believe that by empowering immigrants and future generations to feel secure, knowledgeable, and proud to be able to manage their finances in this new country, we're also contributing to the prosperity and flourishing of the larger community. For me personally, the most important contribution of the Latino Community Credit Union, or La Cooperativa, is precisely fostering a climate of possibility that dreams can come true even in a climate of fear and deep challenges. Thank you so much for this great honor, and thank you for supporting this important work that is happening in North Carolina for our members and for our families.
Well, let me say that I'm just so pleased to be able to present the next awardee to you. I lived and worked in New York for many years, and so the history of the role and the impact of settlement houses was well known to me. But call me a typical New Yorker, I was really surprised to find out during this year's competition that that exact same work was happening on the other side of the country. In fact, started 100 years ago started in Tacoma, Washington, 100 years ago when the Tacoma Community House was established. So the organization was started to serve a small group of Italian immigrants that were then resettling in that area. And you can imagine what a brave act that was in those days, given how reviled Italian immigrants were and how sure many Americans were then that Italians were unable and unfit to become Americans. I think it's fair to say that this is an organization that doesn't scare easily, and it's one whose mission of helping all people become part of a thriving, healthy community has remained vital and clear through many decades. They have pursued that mission with great energy and care, creating innovative and high-performing programs, particularly in the areas of adult English instruction and workforce training, and they have been generous, sharing their knowledge and power with immigrant groups and other leaders in government and community affairs in Washington State by incubating new immigrant organizations that have gone on to be mainstays in the life of the city and state, and by leading cross-agency efforts to coordinate and improve programs to help immigrants and their children join the mainstream of their new community and country. For the excellence of their programs and their path-breaking leadership on immigrant integration issues over a century that has seen two great waves of immigration, it is our pleasure to award the E. Pluribus Unum Prize to the Tacoma Community House. Please join me in welcoming Liz Dunbar, Executive Director of TCH, and I think key members of your leadership team, to accept the award. Congratulations. You can just drop this one.
Wow. I don't think that'll stand up. Well, thank you very much for the... Oh, yes. Here we go. Don't you want the check, too? Well, thank you so much for that very warm introduction, and thank you so much to the Migration Policy Institute and to the J.M. Kaplan Fund for this wonderful award and for the prize money. As a nonprofit, we appreciate that. With me tonight to help accept this honor and this award are Vice President of our Board of Directors, the Reverend David Richardson. Would you stand, David? And Debbie Reck, our Education Director, who has been at Tacoma Community House for 28 years and has been a mainstay of our organization. So we are very honored and humbled to accept this award, especially in such distinguished company. I've been so impressed by what I've learned about the other award recipients this evening, some of whom were already famous in our eyes before we got here, and we have learned from them and imitated much of their work in their work in Washington State as well. But we're really pleased to be recognized for our 100 years of service and particularly for our work in the last 35 years in immigrant integration. As you have heard and read in the program, we have been working with immigrants and promoting immigrant integration for 100 years. And you might ask, how have we survived and thrived and stayed with that mission all these years? Well, someone else had three principles, and we have three as well. First of all, it's to always respect the immigrant's language and culture, the people who come to us, and provide services that respect those cultures and languages. Secondly, it's that English is the key, and we all know that to be able to successfully integrate in this country, you have to be able to speak English, and that's been, again, the mainstay of our work. We have been providing English as a second language classes most of our 100 years in one form or another. And third, it's to provide multiple services in one location can improve the integration of immigrants and help their success. And you heard some of that from Illinois as well. This whole idea of one-stop shopping is so important to make that integration process easier. But we also believe that immigrant integration, as MPI has espoused for years, is really a two-way process. It benefits us who work in this field, benefits the immigrants themselves, and it benefits the society as a whole. Today, we serve over 3,000 people a year at Tacoma Community House, most of them immigrants from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America, from Eastern Europe. We have 50 full-time staff, 13 of whom are immigrants or refugees themselves. Several of our staff began as participants in our programs, and many of our staff have been with us 20 years or more, which is a testament to how rewarding this work is. I've been working at TCH this time for only about a year, but I have been drawn to this work and to Tacoma Community House for most of my adult life. As a daughter of a Japanese immigrant woman and American serviceman, I have witnessed the immigrant experience up close and personal. Those of us who work in this field do so not for the money, not for the fame, although we're glad to have a little today, but because we believe in the social justice mission and the principles that are the foundation of our work. We are a nation of immigrants, and we appreciate what immigrants contribute to our society. Their values are American values: hard work, caring for family, making personal sacrifices for the benefit of others. So those of us who have the privilege of working with immigrants find their work immensely rewarding as we learn from other cultures, incorporate their values into our lives, and develop lifelong connections with these new Americans. In many respects, our staff are like a microcosm of our American society: diverse, multilingual, and a family. The immigrants who come to TCH each year also benefit from our multilingual, multi-service approach. They're here because they want the American dream, just like everyone else, and we help them on the road to achieve that.
The immigrants who've come to TCH improve their English skills, find jobs, get their citizenship, and learn how to function in American society. They go on to higher education, to start small businesses, to be teachers and coaches, and raise children who are successful workers and professionals in our community. They become citizens and voters, actively participating in our civic life. We also believe that our community benefits because immigrants and refugees are part of the community and contribute to its vitality. They remind us of those values that we hold dear, that we learned from our immigrant parents or grandparents. They enrich our culture with their cuisine, with their entrepreneurial spirit, with their music, with their faith traditions. Like so many other immigrants who have come before them, they add to the tapestry that is the United States, a multicultural and diverse society. We have learned to appreciate the struggles and challenges that immigrants and refugees face and their resilience and strength to overcome them, to make a new life for themselves and their families, is an inspiration to all of us. All of us can experience these rewards and contribute to the success stories of immigrant integration. You can volunteer with an immigrant organization like ours to serve as a tutor, a classroom aide, or an advocate. You can be an advocate for humane immigration policies and services. You can support organizations like those who are honored here tonight. Learning about immigrant cultures and traditions, welcoming them into your community, is a very important way to achieve that two-way integration process. I can testify to the power of knowing and embracing both my ancestors' culture and the American culture. I feel very fortunate to have the benefit of both cultures in my life and to work every day with immigrants and to those who support their efforts. So thank you again for this honor and the prize money. We will share the award proudly with our staff, our volunteers, and our participants, and we will use the funds to maintain and improve our work with immigrants. Thank you.
Our final award winner is Upwardly Global. We've heard much about Upwardly Global today. It just struck us as we were reading the proposal and thinking about UpGLO and knowing the organization that one of the things that's critically important is the issue that it addresses, the underutilization of high-skilled immigrants in our society. According to our research, even before the recession, almost half of Latin American immigrants who arrived in the United States after they were 25 with a college degree were working in unskilled jobs. A third of Africans who arrived with college degrees were working in unskilled jobs. And what this represents in terms of public policy, it's the worst of all possible worlds. It's brain drain in the sending country and brain waste in the receiving country. And the promise of Upwardly Global and the reality of Upwardly Global has been to move these skilled immigrants from the economic margins to the middle class. We were also deeply impressed by the program itself with response to the fact that immigrants often lack networks. They often lack understanding of job search customs, while at the same time, employers lack the resources needed to evaluate foreign-trained candidates' credentials and skills. UpGLO doesn't just work at the firm level. As we've heard, it works at the state level. It works at the international level. And what was particularly striking to us is the masterful use that it makes of over 800 volunteers who coach and train and serve as advocates for the immigrants that come through the program, making it one of the absolutely best examples of two-way integration that we see within the business sector or generally within the society. Let me just close by noting UpGLO's remarkable success rate. Graduates earn much, much more than the cost of the training they receive, which translates in turn into lower transfer payments, but also, for society's sake, into much higher taxes. It is really my great, great pleasure to give the award to Nikki Cicerani from Upwardly Global.
I do. We'll make room. Okay. I realize the only thing standing between me now and either another cocktail or your family or glee is the length of my comments, so I will try and keep them short. I want to start by thanking MPI and the J.M. Kaplan Fund. This is a very meaningful honor for Upwardly Global, but I also want to recognize the foresight and the leadership that they showed in shining a light on this particular issue. I want to also take a minute to recognize and thank the Upwardly Global team and the board. One of our sort of secrets of success, as others have mentioned, is that each and every member has an unwavering commitment to our mission. I want to thank the 800 volunteers and the 100 corporate partners who recognize the valuable contribution of immigrants to America and acknowledge that there's as much to be gained as to be shared in their relationships with our job seekers. I want to note one special volunteer and partner who's joining us today, Michael Privatera. Michael, are you here? There you are. Michael's the leading champion and visionary of our corporate partnership with Standard & Poor's and has demonstrated the kind of leadership. I think that Betsy said, you know, there's no model for this. And Michael said, yep, there's no model. Okay, let's see what we can do. And I want to thank you for that leadership. And finally, I want to recognize the other winners. I have learned so much today. I've become so inspired today. And the hundreds of applicants who I know are as passionate and as dedicated as we are to the successful integration of America's newcomers and to maintaining the heritage of our country as a nation of immigrants. So today, as Michael had pointed out, there's about 1.3 million immigrants in the United States today, and they are college educated, they have the legal right to work, and they are poor. These are newcomers who, in their home countries, were engineers and doctors and teachers. And in the United States, they are nannies and housekeepers and cab drivers, which, again, are noble professions. However, not maximizing for the individual, nor for our country, their full potential. We have accepted that this is a rite of passage for newcomers in the United States. It's to forget their former selves and their accomplishments and who they were at home and to discount their life before the United States. And it was okay to say, but you have no U.S. experience. And it was okay to say, but you didn't go to school here. And the expectation was is that you will struggle to survive so that your children might someday thrive. And I want to say, like many of the things that we need to reexamine about how we operate in a 21st century world, that we need to change that paradigm. On an individual level, the relegation of this group to unskilled employment, it leads to economic struggle. It leads to disenchantment, which we cannot afford as a nation today in our position globally. And it's a loss of hope. I want to use one example, as other of these fine organizations have, about one of our job seekers, Merwan, who's not with us today, but I'd like to tell a piece of his story. Merwan is an orthopedic surgeon from Iraq who fled to the U.S. in August of 2008 after being targeted by insurgents because of his profession. His first job in the United States, cashier at a hot dog stand. Why is this unacceptable? Because each job seeker who we assist back into their professional field, it reaffirms the greatness of this country. It's the inspiring message that wherever you're from, with talent, with hard work, with perseverance, and the all-important little bit of help, you can succeed here. And as Michael mentioned, we've created hundreds of those success stories. For Merwan personally, with our help, and that help includes teaching him how to do the U.S. job search, connecting him with a mentor who is a U.S. doctor to teach him about how to conduct the job search here, what he may need to know about his industry, and our employer partnerships, the people who pick up the phone when we call and say, we've got somebody you probably want to take a look at. Merwan obtained a position back in his field, not as a doctor yet, but as a laboratory technician at Tissue Bank International, where he's earning $37,000 annually with full health benefits. So that's a compelling story. And we have, like I said, hundreds of those. But the view on the macro level is significant. The systemic underemployment of highly skilled and legal immigrants in the U.S. accounts for a minimum a minimum, if we're just talking about even 7% of the population, were to move from those margins of the working poor back into their first position in the professional ranks, you're talking about a loss of, what's the cost of not doing it? My board member asked that question, by the way. The cost of not doing it is a loss of $1.54 billion in lost wages to these new Americans and their families, and $385 million in lost tax revenue to the country and local communities each year. That's also a compelling statistic. But what's really at stake for the United States with changing this paradigm and getting the integration of America's skilled immigrants right? I'd argue that it's the preservation of our economic leadership and national heritage. The marginalization of these individuals means that potential intellectual contributions from the human capital that another country paid for lays waste. So Marwin has since formalized a collaboration between Tissue Bank and the University of California at San Francisco to develop an invention in orthopedic surgery that he first pioneered working in war hospitals in Iraq. So Marwin as a hot dog vendor is not something we can continue to allow when the world's talent now has options about where to go. And while entrepreneurship is certainly a well-trodden path for America's newcomers, it cannot be the only path to success for the first, for the world's first round aspirational and intellectual draft choices. I'm going to put that one in quotes and credit Thomas Friedman. Relicensing hurdles and lack of recognition of foreign degrees, disregard for non-U.S. work experience, gaps in intercultural communications and understanding, they all create significant barriers to workplace reentry for this group. And they might otherwise become the line contributors and intrapreneurs that our companies and our country also needs. So when I listen to the discourse on comprehensive immigration reform, I do feel that we're still missing a critical component. You know, we're proposing to bring more highly skilled immigrants into the U.S., those that would meet the workforce needs. I say great. We say great. But we say, if you look at our neighbor to the north in Canada, who has a policy of high-skilled immigration, they are still struggling with a third of their highly skilled immigrants working in unskilled or low-skilled occupations. We are receiving tremendous demand for our work in the U.S. today. So we know it's not enough to open our doors to the world's talent if there isn't an attendant commitment to integrating them into the fabric of the workforce. Reform of our immigration policies that includes a plan for immigrant integration has to be an economic imperative. And our work is to ensure, when I say ours, I do mean a collective ours, but Upwardly Global, for sure, I can speak for us. We feel like it's our job to ensure that these individuals who held out hope that we could deliver to them their dream, that we work at that level. But we also feel like we're working to make sure that the United States learns all it needs to prepare itself for the next era of global competition. And it's the post-comprehensive immigration reform era. It's where our success in integrating the world's talent will become a determinant in our ability to continue to attract it. So we will put this money to work to build our infrastructure so that we may continue to be around to deliver that message, to deliver more success stories that prove the valuable contributions immigrants continue to make, and to insist that we need the policies, programs, support, and that at an individual level, those who are willing to take leadership positions to ensure that it does happen. So I want to thank you again, Jane Kaplan and MPI, for your support in helping us continue our work.
It's now my great pleasure to introduce Congressman Mike Honda, who since 2001 has represented the 15th Congressional District of California in the U.S. House of Representatives. He serves on the Appropriations Committee. He serves on the Labor, Health, and Human Services Committee, the Education, Commerce, Justice, and Science and Legislative Branch subcommittees in the House. In short, he is not underemployed. Congressman Honda is in his seventh year as chairman of the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus, and in 2007, he was named House Democratic Senior Whip by House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn. He's introduced, very importantly for our purposes, the Strengthen and Unite Communities with Civics Education and English Skill Act of 2009, which I think very much, and I hope very much, embodies the spirit of the awards that we are giving here today and of the conversations that we've had today. I know that it has been a long and arduous day, and we very much appreciate your being here and deeply appreciate the time you're taking. Thank you very much, Congressman Mike.
Good afternoon. Good evening. It's been a long day, but it hasn't been arduous. I started out with this school called Oyster School. It's a bilingual school over on off of Calvert. Spanish and English, Mandarin and English. Pretty cool. Kindergarten, pre-kinders, and they're learning languages in both. They're learning instruction through both languages. So, yeah, it's been satisfactory for me because at least someplace in this world, people are beginning to understand that you can teach content and teach English and still have learning going on in through the primary language. I haven't heard all the speeches here, but I suspect that the first thing that is in order is congratulating the award winners for providing all kinds of great examples of how to go about integrating our newcomers and people who want to be part of this this country. I guess this is the first time I heard the term immigrant integration. I always thought that that's what we wanted to do. But I guess in our history, there's not a lot of things that had promoted this. And you're probably the very first group that consciously is doing this in a way that anticipates our future populations. Not many groups do that in a very thoughtful way. And I guess what you were saying earlier sounds like what high tech always says, you know, we have to be agile, prepared, anticipatory, so that when folks do come here, we're at a level where we can have them utilize their skills at the level that they have and promote it. And also perhaps, maybe I'm reading into this part, that have the English support system so that while they're utilizing the skills and they can learn English. Maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but it does make sense. I mean, a lot of people do come here into this country as doctors, and pharmacists, and professionals because of language barrier. They're underemployed, or they're employed in areas that don't really utilize the skills because we haven't set the system up to be able to accept them or even have any kind of confidence that they know what they're doing because we don't know their language and we can't communicate that very very clearly or very efficiently. The group E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. I guess in Spanish it's de muchos uno, de todos uno, or something like that. And so we are many, and we know that immigrant integration is a critical part of this comprehensive immigration reform. And I'm hoping that our effort to create this CIRASP is one that envelops the idea of job creation, that there are activities there that creates jobs, that engages the immigrants in job creation also. If we look at families who create family small businesses, I know that families, when they get together, or communities, when they get together, they turn around neighborhoods that are depressed. And I see that happening. And I think that economic recovery is one of the things that we can expect from a good comprehensive immigration reform. They represent jobs, tax revenue, and consumer spending. I think my friends on the other side of the aisle understand that jargon. And I think that that should be one of the things they should be thinking about. And that's one of the things I talk about when we talk about really a comprehensive immigration reform and reuniting our families in ways that prevents backlogs and the kind of bureaucratic mess-ups that prevent our families from reuniting. Many families, especially from the Pacific Islanders, Filipinos and others, they experience 10, 20, 25 years of waiting to bring their children or their spouses together. And by that time, their minor children become adults and they got to start all over again, which makes no sense. This whole immigration policy makes no sense. If our immigration department were Nordstrom's, they'd go broke. And so what we're trying to do is make the immigration system like Nordstrom's, to be really consumer-oriented and to make sure that, especially in reuniting families, because that's about citizens and legal permanent residents who are citizens in waiting, to provide them the best service because they are our shareholders. And so in order for us to be, one nation indivisible, or one nation indivisible, the only way we can do that is to face our tough national challenges, which I think our resident in the White House is capable of doing. And we just had to get our forces together to work together, because the things I look for in our immigration reform is workforce training, adult education, economic development, financial literacy, foreign credential certification, and all those kinds of things work towards integrating our newcomers into this country in a much more efficient way. I'm a classroom teacher. I learned Spanish when I was in Peace Corps. I learned the value of languages when I lost it as a child, when Japanese language was my first language, and I regret it every day. I even regret it even more when an Anglo guy stands next to me and delivers a speech in Japanese fluidly, and I'm standing there and saying, yeah, that's what I mean. Given that, I know I can learn it if I spend more time on it. But since I learned Spanish, then I just convert myself into a wannabe. I'm a wannabe Mexican. And so, but I take all these experiences and put this into policies. I think that this is why diversity is so important in this country, that those of us who come from different backgrounds, experiences, different times of the development of this country, and don't forget our history and understand it, the good things and the things that need to be changed, that when we take our experiences and tweak it and convert that into policy, that our policies become more accurate, more laser-like, more efficient, and, if you will, more elegant, because we're part of that experience and we convert that into policy. So the kinds of things that you do and the kinds of things that you work on and the kinds of things you've been awarded for really does underline what it is that we're trying to do. H.R. 3249 that was mentioned earlier, what that does is really strengthens and unites communities with civic education and English skills. And that's what we call it, the Civic Education English Skills Act of 2009. We took that piece and we put it into the CRR. And Luis Gutierrez put that in part of his comprehensive immigration reform. We do that because we know that institutions currently that are teaching English as a second language are underfunded. Places like community colleges, adult education, even companies who put extra effort into their workday for their workforce so that they teach their workforce with who come with languages other than English, they teach them the language of the workplace. And that's a good start, because they're learning English in the context of their experience in their daily life. And that's, I think, one quick way of learning another language. So our bill is to create that incentive and that that reward for doing that, and for people who have prepared themselves to do that also. And I think that hopefully that this effort to promote English language learning will also deter this mentality of English only, and that we teach English in the context of respecting the language that they come with also. And so hopefully this thing about English only is dissipated while we move forward in nurturing and respecting and understanding and engaging, embracing people's languages as they come here in this country. Now, we know that immigrants represent at least two-thirds of the growth in the U.S. civilian labor force, and we've heard the statistics that if you don't do it right, we lose about $1.54 billion a year. And when you mentioned that, I was sitting back there, I said trillion, but that was over 10 years, you know. Just move the decimal point over. And so we know that if we do this properly, the whole effort and the whole wrestling match that we make language as a political football in our K-12 public education would hopefully be dissipated and eliminated, so that we understand that English language acquisition is something that we can provide in our schools while we use the language that they understand through for comprehension. And we call it comprehensible input. And I don't understand how people can think that anybody can learn math with a language that they have no idea what we're saying. But coupling both primary language and second language, people can learn. So you are part of that milieu of folks who are out there helping our society change their attitudes about immigrants, about newcomers, and about the whole idea of a language that sometimes make other people uncomfortable. You've heard of people, you know, being in the midst of companies where someone's speaking another language and someone just says, speak English. And to me, that's just an expression of them being uncomfortable or distrusting. And I don't know. I guess I grew up in a way where if my parents were speaking Japanese, I knew what they were doing. They were trying to tell something to each other about me without me understanding it. Well, I grew to grow, you know, very comfortable in that because I'll figure it out. And so when we do that, I think that as adults, we become a little more comfortable and engaged in trying to understand other people's language. My father used to say that every language, if you learn another language, you walk in someone else's, you walk in another world. I think in Spanish it goes, en cada cabeza es un mundo, meaning that every mind is another world. To the extent that we learn another language and understand that, we can travel and traverse that landscape. But if we don't, at least we should be comfortable in teaching English to people who come with another language and be able to create a society that's stronger and more healthy. And I think, you know, mental health is really important for our folks in this country, where the big battle in Congress is not about money. It's not about, I think, people who are brown or anything else like that. I think it's a cover for the discomfort that they have in people coming in and doing things that they don't understand. And so I think that when we can get them to be more comfortable in another language, I think that things will change. So to the recipients of the awards here this evening, just want to add my thanks to your work and your innovation and making things simpler and easier. Had my mom been around and you had a program for her, I think she'd be talking back to my father in English in a little bit more stronger language. But having gone through that already, she still held her own in Japanese. And so I think that having a language and using it in a positive way is really the effort in the future, and not to use it in a way that's a put-down if there's only one language that someone speaks. So I just want to hope that this work continues to permeate through the different companies and different activities so that eventually people who understand what you understand will speak up for public education, speak up for the children who are going to our schools, speak up and stand up for the parents who don't have the wherewithal to defend what they in their gut feel is right, language does not become a barrier to learning, that language doesn't become a barrier to becoming a full-fledged, you know, in your heart, in your sense of self-esteem, that it doesn't become a barrier to a healthy person. And so I just want to thank you and acknowledge all of you as a classroom teacher and tell you how important it is, because one who lost a language, one who was trying to learn English in a classroom where everybody thought I already spoke English, the integration of my ability to learn more efficiently would have been more smooth. So in the name of those children and those families, I say to you very much, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much, Congressman Honda. We simply could not wrap up the ceremony tonight without saying it's a very brief, but it's a very warm and sincere thank you to our advisory board members. You can't imagine how excited we are that all of these smart, wonderful people stick with us and put, you know, this is not like other advisory boards where, you know, we just use your name and we don't really ask you to participate. We really work this board. So I think that Robert Bray may still be here. I see Christine is here, Christine Brenner, A.J. Chaudhry, Agnes Chow. We had quite a few of you here tonight. Phyllis Eisen, Tamar Jacoby, Audrey Singer, Haida Wrigley, Sherry Steisel. Look at the list in your program and just be envious of us that we could possibly have so many great people helping us with these awards. And now I'm going to turn the microphone over to Brad Davidson, who is a grandchild of the founder of the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and he is going to just do some closing remarks, and then we'll head to coffee. So, Brad, wonderful to have you here, and very eager to hear from you.
It's a little tough to be the last speaker on a two-hour program, especially when I stand between you, hour and a half, especially when I stand between you and drinks and dessert. So the watchword for a good public speaker is to stand up, to speak up, and then to shut up. I intend to do that, but I do want to take a couple of opportunities to, number one, call your attention to the logo of the E Pluribus Unum Award. Many of you will recognize that it is the torch that's held by Liberty in New York Harbor. But there's an expression you're all familiar with, which is it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. And there's certainly a lot of darkness out there, and we all indulge in cursing it probably daily when we read the daily headlines. But the purpose of today's award is to draw attention to the remarkable points of light, if I can use a somewhat dated expression, to the people in this country who work day in and day out to improve the lives of our society. And I'd like us all, through a warm round of applause, to thank the participants and the contestants, basically. Because if today's award winners didn't jazz you up, then you're beyond hope. I would also like to take the opportunity to thank both Con Nugent and Suzette Masters of the Kaplan Fund. They had to run to catch a plane back to New York, but it is their yeoman's work that brought the Kaplan Fund to the Institute. And I'd really like to ask for our last round of applause to be for the three superstars behind the scenes, Dimitri, Michael, and Margie. And the work... the work that these three do and the rest of the staff at the Institute do on behalf of immigrants, on behalf of the United States, and behalf of the world really is astonishing. We feel honored to be a part of it. Thank you for inviting us into your world. And with that, I'd like to adjourn the meeting and move out for dessert.
For more information about MPI's work on immigrant integration and the 2010 E Pluribus Unum Prize award winners, please visit www.integrationawards.org.